One could be forgiven, on a hot afternoon like this, for praying for a breath of wind to cut through the frying haze. Ipu had spent all morning hoping, praying for a gust, the faintest breeze as she huffed and sweated. When it came, however, blowing out of the eastern desert and through the wadis that led to the Nile, Ipu cursed her wish. All the wind did was stir up a thick cloud of dust in her eyes, while the moving air sweltered to the point that she felt she was standing in front of one of the fires used to melt down the quarry workers' copper chisels. Wind or no wind, the building site offered no shade to Ipu and the hundreds of other Egyptian workers laboring under the desert sun. Most wore as little as possible, stripped down to simple loincloths, kilts, or short tunics. Dirt stained their meager garments and clung to their skin. The sweat running down their foreheads and cheeks cut little trails through the grime. Everyone moved slowly, hunched over, either from the crushing weight of the stone blocks they carried or from simple exhaustion. Ipu heard a sharp cry from somewhere back along the line of quarters, closer to the limestone quarry. It sounded like a child. She was a mother herself, or had been, until her husband and their baby had died the previous year. But the instinct to run and make the little one feel better was undeniable. Nobody else was moving to investigate, so Ipu handed off her block to the next worker in line and ran off to try to find the source of the cry. A throng of dusty laborers clustered around someone on the ground. As Ipu had thought, it was an adolescent, a girl who couldn't have been older than 12. A block had fallen onto her foot, pinning the appendage. Three men were trying to lever the block off her trapped limb, but every time they started to shift it, the girl screamed in pain. Ipu knelt down next to her and started talking, telling her that everything would be fine, even though she knew it wouldn't be. The girl would be disabled for life, and that was if she was lucky. If she wasn't, a fever would come, the foot would rot, and she would die after days or weeks of agonizing pain. Ipu had seen it happen many times. A shouting overseer, whose bronze-tipped spear was taller than he was, shouted at the workers to get back to their tasks. The king's new city wasn't going to build itself. Ipu left the girl's side and went back to her place in line, accepted the next block, and felt her back twinge in pain. How long would it be, she wondered, before she was the one pinned beneath an unyielding chunk of limestone? Hello, my dear friends, and welcome to another episode of Past Lives. I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thanks so much for being here today. While ancient Egypt seems to be defined by its conservatism and stability over many thousands of years, the lands flanking the Nile were never immune to change. Settlement patterns shifted gradually over time, with people moving in and out of cities and villages, abandoning some and founding others. The country's borders changed as generations of kings led their armies in every direction. Sometimes they dominated territories hundreds of miles away from the river, while at other times, rulers could barely control anything beyond the walls of their own palaces. Migrants entered Egypt from Libya, Nubia, the Levant, and even Crete. Artistic and literary styles went in and out of fashion. New gods came and went, and Egyptian religious beliefs accommodated tremendous diversity in thought and practice. For the most part, however, these were slow-moving shifts that took decades, centuries, or even longer to fully manifest. Things changed in Egypt, but they did so at a pace commensurate with the Nile's languid progress through the black land the river deposited with the floods every year. Not so with the age of Akhenaten, one of Egypt's most famous and enigmatic kings. Akhenaten ruled around the middle of the 14th century BC, between about 1353 and 1336 BC, give or take a couple of years. He was, we think, the father and predecessor of Tutankhamun, whose everlasting fame belies the actual limited extent of his accomplishments while ruling Egypt. Regardless of their relationship to each other, we know that Akhenaten was a far more active king than Tutankhamun, and that he spent his entire 17-year reign fundamentally reshaping Egyptian religion. It would be fair to call Akhenaten a zealot, though prophet might be a better term. In a time and place where numerous deities had always been the norm, Akhenaten was one of the world's first monotheists, focusing all of his attention on the disk of the sun, known as the Aten. Not only were the old gods not worthy of state support and worship in Akhenaten's estimation, they didn't even exist at all. Only the Aten did, and only the Aten mattered. This program of religious reform made Akhenaten's reign one of the most innovative and disruptive in all of Egypt's long and storied history. Temples that had been receiving state support for centuries suddenly saw their coffers dry up. A culture that had made offerings to hundreds of gods, from Amun, the patron deity of Thebes and the New Kingdom pharaohs, all the way down to Meretseger, the local snake goddess favored by the builders who worked on the Valley of the Kings, was suddenly ordered to stop. In just a few years, the Aten was everywhere, carved on official buildings, mentioned in prayers, and sung to and about in hymns. Aten was even worked into the king's name, which he changed from Amenhotep IV to Akhenaten, the one who is beneficial to the Aten. Practically overnight, Akhenaten completely transformed the familiar religious world of ancient Egypt, centering a formerly polytheistic society on a single god. For the elites tied closely to wealthy temples and the Egyptian state's various administrative offices, these changes were particularly shocking. Their bases of material support and political and cultural prestige were under attack. But for the vast majority of the common folk who lived under the rule of the new kingdom, the farmers and shepherds and salt-of-the-earth laborers, the real impact of Akhenaten's rule came in a different form. The building of temples, roads, and palaces, a whole new city on the east bank of the Nile that we call Amarna and they called Akhetaten, fell to them. These workers paid the physical price for years of cutting and hauling stone, digging out foundations, and the thousand other tasks that ruined the bodies and shortened the lifespans of those who weren't lucky enough to be born into priestly or administrative families. Now, thanks to decades of excavations and new analyses, we can understand what the daily lives of Amarna's working class were like. And that's who we'll meet today. But first, we're going to start by grappling with exactly what Akhenaten's ambitious program of transformation entailed. I mentioned earlier that despite the impression of extreme conservatism, ancient Egyptian culture in general, and religion in particular, were always in flux. Akhenaten wasn't the first ruler to make intentional alterations to the religious landscape. Amun, the patron deity of Thebes, hadn't been all that important until Theban kings took over the state in the Middle Kingdom. New Kingdom pharaohs, who had also been regional rulers of Thebes prior to reunifying the country, retained that focus. Horus, by contrast, was the quintessential god of kingship during the early dynastic in the Old Kingdom, and while he kept those associations, other deities would eventually join him. Temples had been inseparable from the state apparatus since the early dynastic, receiving subsidies and support, and generally overlapping with the official structure of administration. As you might expect in a land as sunny as Egypt, solar worship had a long history there. By the time of Akhenaten's reforms, the Aten, the disk of the sun specifically, rather than the sun as an abstract concept, had been worshipped in Egypt for at least 600 years, since the Middle Kingdom. In fact, from the Middle Kingdom to the 18th dynasty at the start of the New Kingdom, it was common to refer to the lands ruled by the king as that which the Aten encircled. Akhenaten's father, Amenhotep III, had also heavily featured the Aten in his official imagery. Akhenaten didn't invent his patron deity. Despite those predecessors and antecedents, it's impossible to overstate the actual radicalism of Akhenaten's program. He began his reign at a time when Egypt was internally stable and at peace with its neighbors, which is probably what gave him the leeway to embark on his great project of religious reform. At the beginning, however, he looked much like any other king. Early in his reign, we see him making offerings to the various gods and smiting Egypt's enemies with a mace, as he was expected to, though even then his iconography included more solar imagery than the norm. As his reign progressed, Akhenaten's intentions as a new kind of religious ruler became clearer. He conspicuously chose not to add on to the existing temple complexes at Karnak, and ignored Amun-Ra, the patron god of the New Kingdom pharaohs. Instead, he built his own temples for the Aten. Then, at the Hebsed festival he held a few years into his reign, he officially changed his name from Amenhotep to Akhenaten, the one who is beneficial to the Aten. All support for other temples ceased. Akhenaten's own views, or perhaps his tolerance for reform, shifted away from emphasizing the Aten above other deities to denying those other deities' existence entirely. In effect, Akhenaten became history's first documented monotheist. For Akhenaten, this seems to have been a genuine and deeply felt religious conversion. For a very long time, scholars have emphasized the political contours of Akhenaten's actions, namely that he was trying to dislodge the entrenched, wealthy, and powerful priesthood that dominated the temples of Amun-Ra and the entire region around the capital, Thebes. Amun's temple at Karnak alone controlled huge amounts of land and thousands upon thousands of dependents, and the temple's resources only grew as conquering kings gifted plunder and people to religious establishments. Akhenaten, some would say, was simply cutting out the middleman and reclaiming control of resources that had slipped beyond the royal grasp through this innovative religious reform program. I should point out here that the high priests of Amun did eventually take over Upper Egypt when the new kingdom crumbled in the Third Intermediate Period after about 1100 BC. If Akhenaten was concerned about this possibility, then his reasoning was well-founded. In the end, however, it's much more productive to see all of that as being downstream of Akhenaten's real religious beliefs, a nice bonus for the institutional solidity of Egypt as a royal state. Creating a new center of power was at the very top of Akhenaten's list of priorities. If we emphasize the political dimension, then he was trying to get away from Thebes, the territory held under the thumb of the people most opposed to his reforms. If we choose to focus on his devotion to the Aten, then it was absolutely essential that he create a new ritual landscape in which to perfect and disseminate his new religion. This was Akhetaten, the place we now know as Amarna. Akhetaten was built about halfway between Thebes and Memphis, the two most important urban areas in New Kingdom Egypt. Akhenaten picked the site personally, and builders laid out the major monuments in a narrow strip of land running north-south, parallel to the Nile. This was intentional so that the Aten would traverse the city over the course of the day. While all of this was planned from the beginning, probably working from a set design, the city grew so quickly that those plans never matched the reality we can see on the ground. Within just a few years, Akhetaten went from an empty plot of land to a city with tens of thousands of residents. The cemeteries contain the remains of at least 10,000 individuals of all ages and sexes, so we can conservatively estimate the total population of the city at somewhere between 20 and 50,000. Akhetaten was effectively a royal boomtown. It was a boomtown in more ways than one. Not only did it grow with extraordinary speed, driven by the requirements of a king wielding nearly absolute power over his subjects, it disappeared just as quickly. Akhenaten died in the 17th year of his reign while probably still in the prime of life. Almost immediately, his radical reform program collapsed. His successor and likely son had borne the name Tutankhaten. In an explicit rejection of Akhenaten, he, or more properly his advisors, because he was a child, soon changed his name to Tutankhamun, restoring Amun worship and the old temple's support. After that, Akhetaten was abandoned as priests and political officials and the tens of thousands of workers who made their comfortable lives possible decamped for Thebes and other places less haunted by the ghost of a despised former ruler. Within just a few years of his death, Egypt's political elite had begun to scrub Akhenaten's name from monuments and destroy images of him, a deliberate act of erasure from Egyptian history. For us, however, this damnatio memoriae and the rapid departure from Akhetaten left a treasure trove of archaeological material. The site we call Amarna is a time capsule, a place that was intensively occupied only for about a decade, and then almost completely left to the less-than-tender ministrations of the surrounding desert. Its temples, palaces, and humble houses collapsed. The sands covered their foundations and low mud brick walls. The thousands of shallow graves in the commoners' cemeteries were forgotten. Yet now, thanks to new excavations and new analyses, we can understand what brought people to Akhetaten, what they experienced while they were there, and what eventually killed them. Amarna is one of the most remarkable archaeological sites on the planet, and the work archaeologists have conducted there over the past few decades has transformed our understanding of how non-elites lived in ancient Egypt. More than anything else, that's because of the sheer quantity of material present at the site. Dozens of monumental buildings, a variety of opulent tombs for the rich and powerful, thousands of houses for the non-elite, and commoners' cemeteries that are currently estimated to hold more than 10,000 burials. Most of the time, we're lucky to get a few dozen burials, but at Amarna, archaeologists routinely analyze collections of hundreds of individuals. 260 in one recent doctoral dissertation, 252 in a journal article, more than 400 in another published article. Moreover, because the site immediately fell out of use after Akhenaten's death, almost nobody came back to build over the cemeteries or dig down among the skeletons of Akhetaten's long-dead residents. We don't have to worry about dating different phases of use or untangling complicated layers of occupation. As archaeological sites go, Amarna is a treasure trove, almost pristine, particularly for the study of working-class Egyptians during Akhenaten's rule. While we're most familiar with the elite aspects of ancient Egyptian history, pharaohs, pyramids, vast tombs filled with riches, and the like, the wealthy and the powerful were never more than a tiny portion of the country's population. 3 to 5% at most is a good estimate. Most of the people living in the Black Land around the Nile were farmers or herders. Others worked as craftspeople or laborers, cutting limestone in quarries or forming mud bricks. Still others spent their time pulling fish from the river or transporting goods in reed boats. A great many did a bit of everything, depending on the time of the year and the needs of their family and community. None of these people would have had a glittering tomb carved into a hillside over the course of years, much less a pyramid. Unless they were present to carry out a task for their social betters, none of Egypt's common folk would ever step foot in a palace or an elite residence. If they ever caught a glimpse of the king, which few surely would, it would be during a stage-managed procession or some other rare public event. The everyday objects they made and used don't form the basis for famous museum collections. But if you happened to be born in ancient Egypt's new kingdom, you were much more likely to spend your days knee-deep in Nile mud than riding a chariot through the streets of Thebes or poring over scrolls of papyrus. Endless toil was the lot of most Egyptians. And at Amarna, we can see the toll that labor took on the country's common people. Given that non-elites made up 95 to 97% of the population of ancient Egypt, this was not a homogenous group of people, a mass of have-nots as opposed to the haves at the top. Ancient Egyptians themselves, or at least the elites who wrote the texts that have come down to us, did see the world that way, drawing a stark binary divide between rich and poor. The reality, however, was much more complex. The ranks of the non-elite included skilled artisans with secure government jobs and housing, like the workers who lived at Deir el-Medina and built the tombs in the Valley of the Kings. These people were sometimes mummified, had tombs with high-quality furnishings, and never experienced long periods of hunger or privation. They did have regular contact with members of the elite, namely the officials who oversaw key projects, which building royal tombs certainly were. But below those middling artisans, scribes, and overseers lived the vast majority of ancient Egyptian society. In art, these people were depicted with frizzy, unkempt hair, hunched backs, and were visibly smaller compared to their elite overlords. Even they may not have occupied the very lowest rung of ancient Egyptian society. This station belonged to the so-called bad poor, who were below even the farmers, herders, and day laborers. Amarna is one of the unique sites where we can see that often overlooked group at the bottom of the New Kingdom society. The masses of people who hefted stone for construction, dug out foundations, and did the hardest of the hard labor that kept ancient Egypt growing and running. We can find these people in huge numbers in two well-excavated burial grounds, the North and South Tombs cemeteries. Both contain thousands of individuals packed together cheek by jowl, even in death. A shockingly high proportion of them are young. They went into their graves with very little. The remains were wrapped tightly in fabric, then placed in a burial container of woven plant fibers before it was placed in a small pit dug into the sand. While many graves have been haphazardly robbed over the millennia, even undisturbed burials contain almost no items. At most, a pottery vessel filled with food or drink, a simple amulet, or a tube of coal for makeup might be left behind. If they were lucky, a surface marker, a small limestone pyramid, or even a few piled up rocks might let the living know where the dead resided. Because the sheer number of people buried in these cemeteries is so large, and the conditions of preservation so good, we can analyze not just individual people, but the entire non-elite population that resided at Akhetaten. Their age and sex, the level of childhood stress they experienced, their exposure to disease, and the patterns of trauma and musculoskeletal stress markers their activities left on their bones. The results of these analyses are, in a word, horrifying. They reveal a population that suffered from malnutrition, malaria, physical mistreatment, and quite literally backbreaking labor. Their work, combined with the general conditions of their lives, killed most of them before they ever reached the age of 25. The simple conclusion is that these were poor folk who lived short, difficult lives. We can go beyond basic impressions, though. A 2013 paper led by the Egyptologist Barry Kemp examined 159 individuals from the South Tombs Cemetery, 95 adults and 64 sub-adults. The adults were extremely short compared to other samples from ancient Egypt, with women standing just over 5 feet tall, 154 centimeters, and men at 5 foot 4 inches tall, 163 centimeters. The children were no better off, showing signs of delayed growth starting as early as 7 months of age and continuing throughout childhood. More than 40% of these individuals, both children and adults, showed signs of cribra orbitalia, porosity of the bones around the eye sockets, a common sign of diets lacking iron and other essential nutrients. At least 8 children had obvious markers of scurvy. The people interred at the North Tomb Cemetery were even worse off. Analyzing 252 individuals, a 2019 study by Gretchen Dabbs found that 93.7% of those buried were between the ages of 7 and 25. Both men and women were shorter than the South Tomb sample, with both the men and women constituting the smallest populations on record from any period in ancient Egyptian history. More than 70% of those 252 people had linear enamel hypoplasias on their teeth, thin lines that indicate periods of intense childhood stress. Wherever they had come from before moving to Akhetaten, their lives had been hard from the moment they were born. Aside from nutrition and disease, the activities in which these people habitually engaged, both before and after arriving at Akhetaten, were brutally difficult. Compared to other ancient populations from around the world, Egyptians generally don't seem to have had to work as hard. The fertile alluvial soil around the Nile was easy to till, and extremely high crop yields meant that there was plenty of time to devote to other activities. The people excavated in the North and South Tomb cemeteries are the exception to that rule. They show larger, stronger muscle attachments than any other ancient Egyptian sample from any period, particularly in the lower body. Among the individuals preserved well enough to analyze at the South Tomb Cemetery, the anthropologist Heidi Davis found that 43% had arthritis in the long bones and 54% had arthritis in the spine. The proportions are slightly lower for the North Tomb Cemetery, but still shockingly high, especially when we consider the age range of the population. Remember, these were mostly young people. Fully 70% of the sample from South Tombs died before the age of 35 and almost 94% before age 25 at North Tombs. Degenerative joint disease is progressive. It becomes much more visible in the skeleton as an individual ages. It's almost unheard of to find cases of degenerative joint disease in subadults, primarily because the bones of children and adolescents are constantly growing and remodeling. Yet in the Amarna cemeteries, children as young as age 6 show signs of degeneration. Full-blown fractures of the bones were even more common. More than half of the people buried at South Tombs had a broken bone somewhere in their torso, with compression fractures of the spine being the most frequent. 3/4 of those with one broken bone had multiple fractures. Broken collarbones and arms were a regular occurrence. Broken legs, while less common, were still chronic. The people buried at North Tombs were no better off. So what were these people doing that left such vicious, debilitating scars on their bones? We could be certain that it was hard and dangerous, and the specific nature of the skeletal lesions offers some clues. Akhetaten was constructed almost entirely from limestone blocks of standardized size and shape. These talatat, as they're known, measured 1 cubit by 0.5 cubit, or about 20 by 10 inches, and weighed about 70 kilograms. That is 155 pounds. From artistic depictions, we know ancient Egyptian laborers carried talatat on their shoulders or heads. This would account for the extraordinarily high proportion of injuries to the axial spine, while falling blocks are an easy explanation for the many broken clavicles and arm bones we see among Amarna's dead. A few individuals, 5 in total, from the South Tomb Cemetery show even more horrendous injuries, what are called slot-type fractures on their shoulder blades. These were piercing injuries inflicted by a spear, the result of a punishment ritual that was normally performed on pigs. At least 5 people were punished in this way, with spears repeatedly stabbing into their backs. This didn't kill them immediately. The lesions on their scapulas show signs of healing, meaning that they were kept alive long enough to die of something other than the immediate trauma. Whatever these 5 individuals had done, their overseers punished them brutally for it. Can you imagine spending your days in sweltering, inescapable heat hauling 155-pound blocks, passing them from person to person down an assembly line from quarry to building site? Given the small statures of the people we're discussing, the talatat probably weighed more than they did. Day after day, month after month, the Egyptians who would eventually perish and be buried in nearly anonymous graves in the North and South Tomb Cemeteries hefted limestone, ate poor quality food, and did their best to survive. Some of them were subject to additional vicious oversight, which included not just corporal punishment, but outright torture. The contrast between the glittering lives of the New Kingdom's elite and those of the downtrodden masses who built their palaces and temples couldn't be more stark. The people who came to Amarna, worked, and died there were among the lowest in ancient Egyptian society. Their lives consisted of endless, brutal labor that started in childhood and ended with their deaths. They didn't have enough nutritious food to eat. They were subjected to rampant outbreaks of disease. Their literal growth was so stunted by severe systemic stress that no other group we've ever found from ancient Egypt was smaller in stature. We almost never have access to this group of people. Their graves were barely marked or unmarked entirely. They didn't enter the afterlife with a rich panoply of goods. They left behind no hieroglyphic or hieratic writing to tell us about themselves. And when elites deigned to write about them, their tone was at best sneering. Where these impoverished folk lived before they came to Akhetaten, we can't say yet. Maybe future stable isotope and ancient DNA analysis will give us clues as to how this workforce was assembled. I sincerely doubt all of them were there by choice. Yet they were still people. They laughed, loved, cried, and suffered. Women plaited their hair in elaborate braids. A surprising number of complete hairstyles still survive in the arid conditions in Amarna, and occasionally left crude portraits of the dead atop their humble grave markers. Whatever the kings and priests at the top of ancient Egypt's social hierarchy thought of them, no matter how they abused these people, they were human beings. It was their work that built Akhenaten's glorious new city of the sun. They paid the physical price for his program of religious and political reform. More than 3,000 years later, they deserve to be remembered. Next time on Past Lives, we'll move south along the Nile from Amarna to a smaller, more intimate, and frankly, more welcoming setting. Its residents knew this place as Set Ma'at, the place of truth. To us, it's Deir al-Medina, and its inhabitants were the builders of the stunning tombs that survive to this day in the Valley of the Kings. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure to subscribe to our Patreon. It's linked in the description here. The Patreon is only $7 a month, and you get tons of great bonus content, like Q&As, interviews with scholars, and much more. It's thanks to subscribers like you that we can make this show. If you're already a subscriber, you rule, and thanks so much. If you haven't checked out my new book, Lost Worlds, you should. It's all about prehistory and what we can learn from the distant past. You can follow me on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick or on Blue Sky at Patrick Wyman. Past Lives is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The producer is Morgan Jaffe. The music and sound design is by Gabriel Gould. The story editor is Rachel Cambouri. This has been Past Lives.